I'm Jonathan Hirsch, and you're listening to Arrivals. And just a quick note before we get started today, if you're just tuning in, I recommend that you go back and listen to our last episode, which is part one of The Adventures of Joe Lombroso. Today's episode will make a lot more sense if you do. And thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the show.
And you know what the Lord said back to him? I'll tell you, after we hear this next testimony about Philip in England. He used to feel the same way. This is his testimony.
One day, my mom and I were walking through the park, and we saw a very tall Arab man coming towards us. I was a little bit nervous at the thought of going up and witnessing to him, so I prayed for the Lord to give me boldness. So I went up and said, "Excuse me, sir, do you want to go to heaven?" I think the Arab man was a little surprised to hear that from such a small boy, so he squatted down to talk to me. Pretty soon, he prayed with me to ask Jesus into his heart. Then, he stood up and raised his arms in the air and said with amazement, "This little boy changed my life."
All right, cool, dude. I'm ready if you are.
Tight. I don't remember where we left off at.
I do. I'm Jonathan Hirsch, and you're listening to Arrivals. The Children of God, or sometimes called the Family, was founded in California in the late 1960s. Family is a fringe religious group with a worldwide following. Their leader refers to himself as a prophet, as Moses, as a king. The group has become infamous for many of their practices, including the use of sex as a missionary tool. Today we get an inside look of life inside the cult, part two of The Adventures of Joe Lombroso.
I think we cover my second stay in India? So after living in Bangladesh for a while, I ended up, my family ended up moving back to India. I don't remember too much anything that happened in the beginning of our stay there, but at some point my sister and I were sent to live in like a boarding house, and we had what they called a foster family. Kind of, I imagine what boarding school would be like, and you know, I was in a household with a couple hundred people, but I started getting in really heavily into trouble, and for not necessarily like bad things, like I was really into making people laugh, so I'd get in trouble for making jokes. They called it foolishness, and I have like some really negative memories from you know, I witnessed kids being abused and saw things and experienced things that just weren't pleasant. Also, I was having like really, really heavy ear infections, like consistently, that I was not being treated for them, so I was constantly in pain. And it was really as simple as like give him a little bit of ibuprofen and an anti-inflammatory and he'll probably be all right, or whatever it is, but they just didn't believe in it. But it started getting to the point that they had to take me to a doctor. And then one day my parents showed up to this house that we were staying at, and an interesting thing when you're living in a commune in Asia in this cult is when you came into the house, there'd be sort of like a room where you would take your shoes off, which is customary in most parts of Asia, and you would kind of stay in that room and you would have to change from your outside clothes. Probably made sense when you're living in a place like India to sort of separate the disease from, you know, all the kids that were living in the house, but it was sort of like a, you know, you weren't clean until you shed everything that you had from the outside world and put on, you know, your kind of indoor clothes. And it really, I think, added to the psychological separation of us being in this commune and them, the world outside of there, which they, you know, they raised us to fear. They told us that they were the enemy, that they, you know, even times that they wanted to kill us. And so it was like, you know, it was a fear thing to get us to stay in the cult, you know, long term, but also immediately. And so my parents came over and we were sitting in this room and they announced that we were going to move, and we got a vote from our family about whether or not we go to Thailand or Japan. I was unanimously outvoted by everyone else in my family, and we ended up going to Thailand. going to Thailand, like, seeing automatic doors that open for you when you walk in front of them. I remember my sister, who was like 11 or 12, in the airport being like, look, everyone, an escalator. We had never seen an escalator since we left France, you know, which had been like at this point like 4 or 5 years. And, you know, in our young minds, like, the world to us was like, you know, Asia and just Asia. Like, eating jackfruit and durian and rambutan made more sense to me than eating an apple. Like apples were like a fantasy fruit for us because we just, you know, they just don't grow in Asia like mangoes do. In most parts of Asia, this isn't like exclusive to the cults. You have cinder block walls with broken glass concreted into it so that people won't hop your walls and, you know, whatever, abuse your property or steal your stuff or whatever it is. But I would, you know, kind of climb up onto the wall and make friends with people on the other side of the wall. And this is sort of the first time where that was working. And I started imagining a world much more beyond, you know, the cult. And I started realizing how much of a cult we actually were in. It was around this time, also in Songkhla, where I witnessed like a military coup, like tanks driving down the street one day. I saw a guy get shot down in a field across the street from our house, like by military or police. I didn't really know. The first Iraq war kind of started, and we were in a Muslim part of Thailand, and Muslims were reacting negatively to us. So I started imagining the world much bigger than the scope of my immediate life. I remember less of the time where I was 11 to 13 than I do the years leading up to it. A lot of it was because I had absolutely... I was suicidal. I was seriously suicidal, you know, like, but in an idiotic way. I was 11 and I'd go in the bathroom and try to stab myself in the neck with a fork, like, because that was all I had access to. I also didn't really have any type of education or knowledge, or, you know, and then there was also the straight up fear of dying. And being told that, you know, I was going to get punished by God afterwards, too. Bizarre things happened to me. Like, at one point, forget what I did. I probably actually did it because I forget what I did. But as a punishment, I had to walk up and down a flight of stairs 200 and some odd times. And it resulted in me getting a hernia, like, that I suffer from still today. And you know, there's, like, little... Like, I confronted an adult for improperly touching a girl, and he grabbed me by my neck and held me off of the roof of a 7-story, you know, building that we were in. The important thing to remember about the philosophy of the cult is that David Brantberg, who was the founder and the guru, they never use the term guru, and I don't know if it technically applies, but he's their founder and leader, and, you know, they basically worshipped him. You know, he did some time in the military, did, you know, whatever stories, which may or may not be true, that we were all taught. He kind of found a niche during the hippie days by reaching out to people with, you know, Christianity and trying to give it, like, a new spin and a new edge.
So here's a little history on how God's children travel and have been traveling. From the earliest times, God's men have always been on the move for the Lord. These all confess...
The Children of God was born out of the 60s, early 60s hippie movement. There was even acid in the beginning of it, as far as I believe. There's a lot of footage you can find of it, and it looks like Woodstock, a bunch of naked-ass hippies dancing and praising the Lord Jesus.
That after all, we've strayed and yes, we've been bad. We're thankful for your love.
Kind of looks like fun, like, other than the religious components, sounds like Burning Man. You know, and a whole lot less drugs. I don't know how much less, but less. And, Jeremy Spencer, who was like the lead guitarist for Fleetwood Mac, had joined the cult and was making their music back then. And, you know, there's a lot of, like, they had a lot of things kind of going for them, and they were hanging out on Huntington Beach playing guitar and collecting hippies. David Berg is a known pedophile, and he's a clear horn dog, and he engineered his teachings to basically increase his odds of getting laid.
Oh, Dad, we're gonna carry it on. After you're gone, oh, Dad, it's gonna break my heart. The love you've shown to me. After reading your letters, the first thing I thought was Dad.
So he, like, for example, would write a... he was aggressively anti-homosexual, but he wrote an entire, they called him G-Eds or Mo letters, because they called him Mo, which is short for Moses, because he was Moses David leading us through the Sinai Desert or whatever it is.
This is Mo letter number 150, and the title is...
He had like a Mo letter about called The Girl Who Wouldn't, that was basically about a woman who refused to put out for another woman, and he excommunicated her and had people pray against her as a result, because to him lesbianism was something that was, you know, sexual, and it's something that turned him on. So there was a lot of sexuality that was inspired, and as far as I can tell, was just for his personal gratification. And he would have a prophecy or a vision from, you know, whatever spirit he would name that would, you know, justify it and make everybody else involved in it.
Write up exact detail and...
Orgies, I think, are also... So they did something called sharing. And sharing is... they had this philosophy where in this cult, if you're not... You know, if there's someone not getting laid, he's unhappy. They want everyone to be happy because it, you know, projects part of their marketing. So sharing was when you would share your partner with someone else. And sharing ended up being, you know, in various levels, is, you know, from the basic wife swapping to straight up everyone fucking everyone in the living room. So it's not like I was invited to these orgies. They were just going on, and we would show up. We would come downstairs, and no one would stop us. And there's like a lot. There's very much of a lot of 60s and 70s sexual freedom. In the 80s, it started getting a bunch of negative attention.
These are the children of God, young people, many of them former drug users, now living together. Trying, they say, to live the life of Jesus. Trying to convert the world to his teaching.
By 86, they had to change their name as a direct result of child abuse, people going to prison and what have you. And they've aggressively... They have this stance that there's been no child abuse since 1986, where they officially outlawed it. Regardless of their official stance, I am living proof. I'm a witness to the fact that it still continued. Just definitely a lot more hush-hush. By the mid-90s, they wouldn't even let kids under 17 have sex just for PR reasons. The whole time, I was like, it was really obvious that I was having problems, and I was they have these lists that go out. I was on the national list of people to pray for. And I, you know, I changed my name to Francis at one point, so that, you know, to try to show them, because I also kind of realized at one point that my rebellion was getting me nowhere. And I think I had a conversation with my sister where I was like, how can I be more like you? Everybody likes you and thinks you're the good guy and I'm the bad guy. I'm always getting punished and you're always being celebrated. And I, you know, my takeaway from that was kind of like, you know, just keep to yourself. I'm 12, living in Asia. I have no education, no hope, and I've been told hundreds of times that I'm going to die. They would tell me, River Phoenix grew up in the cult. They would constantly bring up River Phoenix. You want to die like River Phoenix? He was probably gay when he died. Like, you know, and there was a lot of like, so-and-so left and look at them now, they're dead. You know, there's a lot of like really like fear of leaving. And then... I don't know how it happened. One day, our parents said, we're moving to America.
This is Mo letter number 150. The title is, Have Faith, Will Travel.
It was like everything I ever imagined it to be. But everybody thought I was a weirdo. Like... Because I was. I grew up in a cult in Asia, and I'm a 13-year-old kid wearing Asian schoolboy clothes with Asian puffy hair, showing up in the 90s trying to talk to other 13-year-olds, and they're just like, who are you? Where's your accent from? Like, but, you know, all of a sudden, I'm not the only white kid around. People don't treat me like an anomaly. They treat me like a normal person when I'm out in the street. And we weren't living in a commune. We were living in a house in Portland, Oregon with three families, and my parents were the leaders of, you know, like a mini cult. It was still part of the group. They have like different tiers, and my parents were still like first tier. But they kind of started like losing control of us, because my parents would go out and we would watch the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and Married with Children on television, and we figured out how to make that work. We found televisions. We'd sneak out and go visit the neighbors.
Now this is a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside down, and I'd like to take a minute, just sit right there. I'll tell you how I became the prince of a town called Bel-Air.
So my brother and I would go out and make money, and he's deaf, and he would have a sign that would say, hi, my name is Isaac and I'm deaf. I work with a Christian nonprofit group and I'm out here trying to raise a couple of bucks. Do you want to buy a poster? And we would only sell posters. And I started carrying the sign too and faking the deaf. And we'd make like $600 in a day in donations. And, you know, some people wouldn't even take the posters. So we wouldn't have to, you know, justify the, you know, we were supposed to come home every day with $200, but we would make $600, and then we'd never had fast food in our life. So we would go to Taco Bell, Burger King, and Blimpie's in the same day. And then when we kind of ran out of junk food to try, we started going to movies. And the very first movie I ever saw in the theater was Independence Day with Will Smith, who I had recently become acquainted with on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And the impact of that movie on me was just so intense. I walked out of the theater not knowing what a director does for a living or a cinematographer is or anything like that, but walked out of that movie theater knowing what I wanted to do.
In approximately 6 hours, the signal's going to disappear and the countdown's going to be over. Checkmate.
You know, wasn't very long after that, I think it was about 4 or 5 months after that, that I just took my shit and left. Things got, you know, better by proxy of getting really dark. You know, I was homeless, in Portland, and just about everywhere I went as a 14-year-old homeless kid, I would show up and someone would say, oh, you're a homeless kid. Talk to so-and-so. In Portland, there was a woman called Big Mama. She was a Native American woman, a real big one. And she would, you know, she kind of took a bunch of the crusty kids under her wings, the actual homeless ones. There was the poser crusties that went back to the home in Beaverton at the end of the day. But she, you know, she'd find the ones that were really desperate and, you know, tell them the safe spots to sleep, give us weed, tell us where we can get food. Like, kind of like, she was like the mama for like 15 homeless kids. So she wasn't taking care of anyone, but she was making you feel like there was a little bit of like structure and order and give you a little bit of advice. And some of it was good because it helped you with survival. And some of it was just her, you know, meandering and opinions, you know, both of which were I was interested in because I'd only been fed the same set of ideals for my whole life. And around this time, like, people also gave me drugs and I started experimenting with drugs a little bit. I wouldn't say experimenting, but I started doing drugs, which didn't really help me in my mental state get positive, but it kind of like, you know, gave me a little time to explore internally. I did a lot of walking and a lot of hitchhiking and some freight train hopping for about 2 years. Along the way, I lived in Acton, California, and worked in a campground raking leaves and emptying sewers. I worked in there's like a wildlife reserve up there that I worked at. I slept in a storage unit with a family in Flagstaff, Arizona. I like traveled around with a white trash trailer family that, you know, took me in for a while. I'd go by Frank at that point, and the street kids called me Frank A, Frank Anonymous, or Frank Asshole because nobody knew anything about me. I wouldn't tell them anything about me, and I kind of was going through this period where I was just sort of in autopilot, like survival, traveling, looking for something, but not really clear what. And I'd like, you know, I enjoyed telling people stories, but nobody believed anything I said because I had such a fantastic life for someone at that age. I also started riding bicycles more and more and started getting really into it, and realizing that you know, how, you know, probably that the build of my body and how often I was doing it, I started getting fast and I wanted to get into racing. And I did it once when I was homeless. I kind of ended up, you know, coincidentally in a bike race and did really well. And I was just not really sure how to do it. And then I started meeting some bike messengers at parties and we kind of became friends and they started inviting me to stuff and I started racing with them. And I started, you know, all of a sudden kind of emerging out of my bubble within these like little sort of outcast scenes that were less likely to judge me for being, you know, a weirdo. And then, you know, kind of flourishing in them where like I would play bike polo all the time and started being pretty good at bike polo. And I started placing in races and I started, you know, becoming a cool kid by the things that I would do. Like I was interested in filmmaking and I owned a small business and we did graphic design. I was really into design. I ended up becoming friends with artists and designers and, you know, we were working in apparel and it just, all of these things kind of together started like building my status to where other people stopped looking at me as like an oddity. Around this time, my sister started being in communication with this kid. His name is Ricky Rodriguez, and he was touted as the like poster child of the cult. His name was Davidito, and he was David Berg's son, even though everyone knew he wasn't, but he was essentially adopted. She started a friendship with him. He was living in Tacoma, Washington, and he was having a hard time. And the reason why he was having a hard time is because he was starting to feel the burden of the damage his family had done to thousands and thousands of kids. When I met him and I found out who he was, I was enraged at him. I wanted to hit him. I couldn't, because I had such a hatred for him, but it wasn't actually for him. It was for what his, you know, parents did and the fact that he was, you know, we were supposed to be like him, and I couldn't care less who he was. As far as I was concerned, he was, you know, the offspring of scumbags. And so we didn't get along particularly very well, but him and my sister kept in contact.
Well, hey everyone. This is Rick, and I'm making this video.
In the mid-aughts, he went on a spree and captured a woman and tried to torture her to tell him where his mother was so he could kill his mother to avenge all of us kids. She didn't say anything, so he killed her, videotaped it all, videotaped an explanation of why he was doing this, and then shot himself.
I'm just loading some of my mags here. Hope you guys don't mind if I do that while I talk.
And then sent the videotapes to San Diego News and a few other news outlets.
Used us as slaves, because that's what we were, every last fucking one of us. No matter how we were treated, we were fucking slaves. Just there, for those sick fuckers' pleasure. That's all it was. That's the way it was at Grandpa and Mama's house. Alright. Okay, well, keep fighting, keep the faith, and all that other stuff. And someday, in some way, some of us are going to be around to see those fuckers burn, literally or figuratively. They're going down. So, with that happy thought, I shall leave you.
So all of a sudden, the cult that had been pretty well contained had its lid blown off. The guru's son basically said, I wanted to torture and kill this woman that raised me so I could find my mother to kill her to avenge all the children that are being abused right now, or that were abused in the past. And all of a sudden, what I had sort of hidden about my life and learned to kind of like sweep under the carpet, like, kind of started coming back out again a few years after when I started living a normal life.
On the tape, Rodriguez lays out his plan to murder a leader of a religious sex cult called the Children of God, also known as the Family.
A lot of kids my age started becoming more and more vocal. There was a wave of press. There was articles in Rolling Stone magazine and Marie Claire and on television. And that kind of like, you know, gave me a chance whether or not I wanted to go back and look at what was happening. And I'm pretty sure that event, because of how bad it was for their PR, forced like half of the people that were willing to stay in the cult to leave. You know, I'm a scrappy fucker. Like, I'm always worried about, you know, I had an hour-long conversation with a director today who had the less turbulent lifestyle than I did, and he was like, man, you're always thinking about the bottom dollar. You got to think about the art. And I'm like, well, here's the difference between you and me, man. Your parents are going to pay your rent if you fuck up. If I fuck up, I'm homeless. Like, there's no in-between for me. So yeah, there is some scrappiness that comes with the as part of the package. But I think that really it's a wiring thing. And I think that, you know, the opposite of this, you know, spectrum, there are people like peers of mine that I grew up with that, you know, in their early 20s, like, murdered a couple of people in themselves or, you know, that are now in prison for life. A good chunk of my peers growing up are, you know, committed suicide. I don't see like being a victim of the life that I led, if we're gonna use the term victim. Everyone has their hard times, and you know, like, you don't have to let the negative shit define you.
Special thanks to Joe for sharing his story. This program was produced by me, Jonathan Hirsch, with help from our associate producer, Nora Lind. Our illustrations, as always, come from the amazing Steph Tan. Arrivals is a member of The Herd, a collective of 8 independent producers from across North America who have come together to share their resources and to promote each other's work. Find out more at theherdradio.com. That's HEARD radio.com. And you can find out more about this show by visiting our website, ARRVLS.com. Leave us a review on iTunes, find us on Stitcher, Spotify, Pocket Cast, Acast, or really wherever you like to listen to podcasts. I'm Jonathan Hirsch, and thank you for listening. And until we meet again, may you wind up where you need to be.